This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
The US election is 6 months away. The economy is booming, but the issue on which President Biden seems most vulnerable to his Republican rival Donald Trump is what Americans call the border, by which they mean the number of people who are crossing from Mexico to the US without authorization, week in, week out. Last December alone, 250,000 people crossed over. Who are they? Where do they come from? Why so many? Why now? And how is any administration, Democrat or Republican, going best to tackle the challenges such migration poses? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, I want to find out what's happening on the ground. Gustavo Solis is an investigative border reporter at KPBS television station in San Diego. Gustavo Solis, you've been covering the question of migrants coming into the US over the Mexican border for some time now. Can you tell us what you experience on the ground?
So here in San Diego, really since February, we've seen what people call migrant drop-offs, street releases, really. Every morning, 7 days a week, you see a bus from Customs and Border Protection drop off hundreds of migrants, about 300, 400, in what we call a trolley stop, basically a transit stop in San Diego. And the response from the city and the county, there really is no response, right? At these stops, you see, like I said, hundreds of migrants, no public restrooms, no shelter, no access to Wi-Fi or food. The only kind of help or reception that they're getting right now is from a handful of volunteers who take it upon themselves to go out and greet these people, welcome these migrants into the country.
Just to be clear, who is actually dropping them off?
Customs and Border Protection, basically Border Patrol. How it works is migrants will present themselves at the border or cross in between the ports of entry, where they will be processed by the Border Patrol in a separate facility. After the Border Patrol finishes processing them, they need to get them out of their facility so that they can process the next round of migrants. So once they're done, they're initially vetted, they're given a notice to appear in immigration court, and they're released into the street of San Diego.
Are they released there because the immigration court is in San Diego? Is that the reasoning for why they're there?
No, I mean, you'd think so. That's kind of what would make sense. But no, the migrants here that are released in San Diego, they're going all over the country. Some of the nonprofits have been tracking this, and well over 90% of them leave San Diego. A lot of them go to cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Denver, Houston, Chicago, New York, and they will have the notice to appear in immigration court in that city.
Gustavo, what about the business of claiming asylum? Am I right in thinking that in past years, you didn't claim asylum, you got over the border and you tried to stay in the US, and that nowadays you come to the border and, from what you said, present yourself immediately to the authorities and then claim asylum?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in thinking that, because that is a big change. That explains why we've seen some of the numbers go up, because for a long time, the idea of somebody crossing the border illegally and immediately turning themselves in to Border Patrol was kind of unheard of, right? If you cross illegally, it was because you wanted to avoid detection. That has changed. You know, the migrants, particularly the most vulnerable ones, you know, we talked about pregnant women, people traveling with children, entire families traveling. They are the ones that are most likely going to cross illegally just for the purpose of presenting themselves to a Border Patrol and requesting asylum. And that's a result of U.S. policy that changed during the Trump administration. And it's kind of remained the same during the Biden administration, that they essentially eliminated this process where migrants used to be able to just walk up to a legal port of entry, you know, a legal border crossing, and present themselves that way and try to request asylum that way. That option is largely closed to people. So if you want to do it the quote unquote legal way and walk to a legal border crossing and plead your case, you'll get turned away more likely than not. And that policy decision is forcing or pushing more people to cross illegally in more remote and dangerous parts of the border.
Gustavo, you've been covering the border for 20 years now. How much have things changed during that time?
I think the biggest change I've seen since I started covering this is just the population of migrants, right? And that's a really historic shift in what we've seen in the southern border. I mean, when I was in high school and in college, migrants were predominantly Mexican men looking for work, so much so that Customs and Border Protection, our federal government, had a way of categorizing different migrants by nationality. The biggest one was always Mexican, and the second biggest groups of migrants was called OTM, other than Mexican. Huh. And that kind of tells you just how big of the group it was. Then slowly over time, it went from Mexican men to Central American and Mexican men. And just in the last 5 years, maybe a little longer now, you've seen a shift to unaccompanied minors from Central America, more families from Central America. And now within just the last few years, you see people from all over the world. Eastern Europe, Latin America, Africa, East Asia, it's really all over the place, and more families. So if you think about that, our immigration system, our enforcement and detaining system was built with men in mind, right? So when you bring in a lot of families in, they're coming into a system that wasn't built for them. And that's why you get a lot of issues of people not liking the conditions or being in detained too long and not knowing how to get out of it. And even the Border Patrol, it puts them in a difficult situation of having to care for a population that they don't always have the resources to care for.
Now, you talked about how people other than people from Latin and Central America are now coming to the States, which means that they've traveled a long way, some of them, to get there. Can you talk us through that one? How do people from China or East Asia get to Mexico?
It's kind of happened on and off for a couple of years, but I remember after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we started seeing a lot of Ukrainian migrants and actually Russian migrants too, trying to escape the conflict there. They would fly out of the, you know, Russian Eastern Europe and then get to Mexico from either, you know, go to Cancun or Mexico City and then make their way to Tijuana. Same thing with China. I mean, China has an established commercial relationship with Mexico. There's a lot of Chinese companies doing work in Mexico and a lot of manufacturing in Tijuana. So there are established flights direct from different parts of China to Tijuana and to Mexico City. It's an incredible amount of money and resources that it takes for them to come over here.
Is this a function of essentially networks set up by mobile telephony, essentially, which didn't exist 20, 30 years ago?
That's certainly a big factor. I mean, social media plays a big, big role in this. I remember seeing YouTube videos. I unfortunately couldn't understand them. They were in Russian, but they would show you different spots along the border where you could cross, where other people had crossed. I've spoken with migrants from the Dominican Republic who have seen TikTok videos of where to go, right? And they'll be pretty specific. They'll say, you know, this is the difference between going to Hermosillo versus Tijuana versus Sonora versus Mexicali, and kind of tell you a little bit about those Mexican areas along the border and which ones are safer and which ones are relatively easier to cross. So technology is a huge, huge factor. Almost every migrant you see will have a smartphone, not always the next generation, not always the fanciest one, but one that works and they can communicate with their friends and family, but also access social media and even something as simple as like a WhatsApp group. They share information that way. They share maps and photos and videos of themselves crossing so that other people can kind of follow the route.
Now, you've talked a bit about the obvious reasons why people, say, from Russia wanting to escape a draft, or Ukraine might want to come over, or people from China. But I'm presuming that the majority of people who are coming over are actually looking for better jobs and for better conditions for their families. Is that the right presumption?
Yeah, that's correct. And mostly from, you know, Mexico, Central and South America, that's what you hear a lot pretty often. You hear the economy is not doing very well. There's a lot of criminal activity, criminal gangs in those countries. And it's not like somebody robbing a store, although there's a lot of extortion. They describe it almost like an occupation, right? A criminal gang is kind of running the town. If you have a business, you have to pay protection fees. If you're a young man, you have to join them or they're going to burn your house down. That's more or less what kind of crime they describe. And you see it. I mean, I talked last week with folks from Ecuador who talked about political instability, which kind of matches with some of the things we've seen in the news lately.
Gustavo Solis. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about Britain's missing workers, the one about the future of democracy in India, and the one about assisted dying. Right, back to the US-Mexico border issue. Now I want to find out why the numbers are going up and how the government can deal with it. Joining me are Doris Meissner, Senior Fellow and Director of the US Immigration Policy Program, and Edward Alden, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of When the World Closed Its Doors, The COVID-19 Tragedy and the Future of Borders. Edward Alden, we've heard that in recent times migrant numbers crossing the Mexican border have gone up. Let's go to the why now. Why has it changed? Why are different people presenting themselves there? What's the push and what's the pull?
Well, I think the push factor is political unrest, disruption in a lot of these countries. I mean, Venezuela in particular is badly misgoverned. A lot of people are having trouble even finding food. So there's enormous incentive to leave. You know, Cuba, people have been trying to get out for years. We used to let them in kind of automatically to the United States. That ended some years ago. Central America has dealt with high levels of violence for years. So we could go country by country. There's a big push factor. The pull factor, the United States, and this is true across Europe as well, all of our countries have asylum laws. These were adopted initially in the wake of the Second World War when so many countries did not permit the Jews who were fleeing Nazi Germany to enter their countries. There was a collective shame, and the world said, we're never going to do that again. And so written into U.S. law is if you present yourself at the border and you say, I cannot go home because I face persecution, torture, death for an enumerated number of reasons, my beliefs, my religion, my membership in a particular social group, the United States is obligated by law to take those claims seriously and to adjudicate them and to make the best decision possible about whether those people will be admitted and allowed to live their lives out in the United States or whether they will be sent back to the countries of their origin. And as you can imagine from that description, these are incredibly difficult decisions. The consequences are enormous. And people, you know, across the region and across the world have figured out that the United States doesn't have the capacity to handle this. And so if they show up at the border, even if perhaps they don't have a very strong claim under U.S. asylum laws, they will be, in most cases, admitted to the country, given a court date, sometimes many years out because there's such a backlog. And given the situation they're facing at home, looking at, you know, 2, 3, 4 years of being able to live and in most cases work in the United States, that's a pretty strong magnet for people.
Doris, is it useful to think about how administrations previous to the Trump administration handled this problem? Or is the kind of problem that it is now so different from those administrations, we really should start with the Obama administration?
Enforcement at the Southwest border had come to the point in the Obama administration where they really were able to establish reasonable levels of control. And that was a result of really the post 9/11 period, where significant resources over the course of 10 to 15 years were devoted to border enforcement as part of the overall response of the United States to terrorism threats and to defining the borders and border control as an element of our national security. That resulted in very effective levels of enforcement at the Southwest border, but all of the flows at that time continued to be the young Mexican males. The flows began to change at the end of the Obama administration. And that change in the flows is something that the United States simply has not been able to keep up with and hasn't been able to change the infrastructure or change the overall enforcement strategies in ways that meet the new challenges.
Edward Alden, are we saying that essentially the problem had begun to assert itself by the time President Trump came into office, and that he was confronted with a problem, whether he knew it or not at the time, that was relatively new?
I think that's correct. In fact, I think a lot of Donald Trump's political rhetoric was actually kind of aimed at the earlier problem, you know, the notion that somehow you could build fortifications to keep people out. The thinking there is that these are people who are trying to sneak into the country and get around the Border Patrol, not people who are going to show up and turn themselves in. So even a lot of his campaign rhetoric, which was quite effective politically in 2016, was aimed in many ways at a different problem. And his administration had to adapt. They did so in some rather cruel ways that I and many others believe, you know, violated U.S. laws and U.S. human rights commitments.
And that adaptation that they undertook, very broadly, how would you characterize it? And very broadly, did it work at all?
I would characterize it, and this is a common term in, you know, among immigration people who follow immigration, is deterrence through enforcement. So they came up with different kinds of measures. The Remain in Mexico program, where the Trump administration strong-armed the Mexican government to say, well, okay, somebody shows up from these other countries, claims asylum, the U.S. will record that and then ship them back to Mexico to wait out in Mexico for their adjudication. The hope was, well, this will be a big deterrent because they'll be stuck in Mexico rather than getting into the United States. The worst practice that existed for some months and is still getting sorted out was, Doris had mentioned, the family units arriving. It's difficult to detain family units for a whole bunch of reasons. We don't want to put kids in jail. And so the administration said, well, we're going to separate parents from their children and we will, you know, detain in prison type facilities their parents, turn the kids over to Health and Human Services in the United States. The result was you had thousands of families separated from their children, created a huge outcry. And then finally, at the end of the Trump administration, as a result of the pandemic, the United States invoked what's known as Title 42, which is an authority under the control of our Centers for Disease Control, which allows the government to block people from entry on the fear that they may be introducing a contagious disease. And so the administration said, well, anybody arriving illegally across the border, because they're going to be held in these what they call congregate settings, Border Patrol holding pens, this is a big risk for spreading COVID, so we're just going to turn them back and we'll immediately send them back. So that was a fairly blanket power to just, when people arrive, you're, you know, country's closed, we have a pandemic, go away. And that stayed in place for years. It was actually, across the world, the last COVID-related border restriction that was lifted anywhere in the world, not until May of 23.
Wow. Doris Meissner, did what Trump do had any effect on what the Mexican government did? I mean, did it have the effect of having the Mexican government try, for a while at least, to clamp down upon illegal migration coming first into Mexico in order to transit to the States and then trying to cross the border into the States?
Well, the situation that we have had now, it makes Mexico be a critical player, as you're suggesting, in a way that has not been the case before, because Mexico had traditionally been simply a source country of migration, over time became a transit country of migration, but is now also destination country of migration. And all of those identities existing together can be quite contradictory in what you do. Mexico is an essential partner in many ways for the United States. over the longer term, putting together migration controls, but it also is a country that does not have nearly the capacity that the United States has. And so large numbers of people coming into Mexico, coming through Mexico, trying to get to the United States, being returned, raises many difficult issues. Administrations have done different things with them. In the case of the Trump administration really pulled out of the toolkit what often is referred to as a nuclear option, and that is that it threatened tariffs against Mexico if Mexico did not cooperate more fully on enforcement with the Trump administration. And indeed, Mexico then did do so and did put some controls in place that had not been the case before. The Biden administration has also worked very closely, but more collaboratively, with Mexico in migration management terms. And it's been quite extraordinary to see that Mexico has agreed with the United States that the United States can return to Mexico nationality groups who are not Mexican. That is very unusual. So in the case of four nationalities, Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, the United States has some special programs that make it possible for people in those nationality groups, if they have a sponsor in the United States, to actually come in a regularized way to the U.S. But if they do not take advantage of those regularized opportunities, they are returned to Mexico with Mexico's agreement, and then Mexico attempts to return them to their country.
Edward Alden, it's clear from what we learned earlier about political opinion in the U.S. that the electorate considers the policy so far of the Biden administration to have failed, notwithstanding the collaboration with Mexico. Can I ask you first, is this a question of numbers, i.e. people think there are too many people coming in, or is it a question of a perception of a lack of control?
I think it's much more the latter. And you're right. I mean, immigration in most of the surveys now, voters consider it the second most important issue after the economy. Now, that's heavily tilted to Republican voters, for whom it's seen as a top issue, and it's central to what will be Donald Trump's campaign in 2024. But I think it is the perception of control. I mean, what the Biden administration is trying to do, and your listeners probably already have a sense of the complexity, they're trying to change the incentives. I mean, the big picture here is people from these countries that we are talking about have few or no legal options to emigrate to the United States. And so if they're in desperate enough situations, they'll look for avenues to come here illegally. What the Biden administration has tried to do since Title 42 was lifted last year is to flip those incentives. There are legal ways now for these people to come, to be vetted in their countries or in neighboring countries, and to come in limited but not insignificant numbers, 30,000 a month, to the United States. And the administration has tried to increase the penalties for those who arrive at the border and attempt to get in illegally. But the numbers have been so overwhelming that this effort to flip the incentives just has not been successful so far.
Which creates an interesting question, because from the outside, you look at America now, you have low unemployment. You have some of the highest growth, I think probably the highest growth actually amongst the developed countries. And you have very high level of migration. Does sort of suggest that migration is helping the American economy grow.
It does indeed. I'm so happy that you asked this, because people rarely think about this, right? The two periods in which we saw the largest unauthorized flows to the United States were in the late 1990s and the current period, when unemployment in both of those periods was down around 4%. I mean, add on top of it, if you look at expected rates of immigration for working age people, and you go back to 2019 and you draw that line, you take out COVID, by 2022, there would have been 2 million more working age people in the United States, but they were kept out by the restrictions during COVID. So you had this huge hole in the labor market, both because of the generally strong economy and because of the COVID restrictions. And I think it is beyond debate that the very large number of migrants coming to the country have been a boon for the American economy. I mean, one of the things that was driving inflation is that there was a shortage of workers. And so wages were going up, and not that wages shouldn't go up, they should, but they were going up at a rate that was not sustainable in terms of keeping inflation under control. Large levels of migration have really helped the United States to get on top of that. There's still challenges on inflation, but we're in a much better position than we were a year or two ago. So a colleague of Doris's and mine, Gordon Hansen, who's now at Harvard University, wrote a piece for my organization, the Council on Foreign Relations, years ago on what he called the economic logic of illegal immigration. These people come and they fill labor market needs. And that's just a powerful magnet, maybe more powerful than all of the political stuff that we're talking about today. The U.S. economy is booming, needs workers, and people are showing up.
From what you've both said, it seems that the asylum system, though, as a form of permitting migration, is broken. What do you both think would be the single best way of trying to fix things in the States? Doris, you first.
Well, let me point to what is truly missing in action here. And what's truly missing in action is our Congress. I mean, we have three branches of government: executive, legislative, judicial. And the effort and the criticism and the responsibility is all situated in the executive branch at the current time. The current administration and President Biden are heavily criticized for the inability to bring order to this, but there are serious limits to what the executive branch actually can do. And the limits have already been exceeded in a number of areas of legal authority. They haven't gone over the line, but they certainly have stretched the envelope farther than has ever been done historically. So if just take the point about the economic impact of migration, it is absolutely true, this paradox of the labor market needs and the people who are coming. But having that labor market need being met in this very disorderly way, it's a paradox. And it is not an acceptable way, ultimately. It's not a system. It's not being done properly. But the reason that it is not being done properly is because our Congress has not legislated on immigration matters that have to do with legal ways of entering the country since 1990. 1990 is how many economies ago? So that if there were better ways and more robust ways for people to come to the country for labor market and employment purposes, we would arguably be able to control and manage and channel these forces in ways that simply right now are not possible.
If I could just add here, I mean, in this political environment, I mean, one of the striking things that happened here early this year was that the Biden administration and congressional Democrats agreed to revisions to asylum policy, which would have made it considerably more difficult for people to show up the border, make these claims, and be released into the country. It went a long, long way to tightening the asylum system in exactly the way that more serious Republicans have been demanding. The president was denounced by some folks in his own party, by the immigrant advocacy groups, by the human rights groups, saying, you know, you're curbing the right to asylum, which is fundamental. He was prepared to do all these things to try to get a handle on the problem. And also Congress was going to appropriate more resources. But Donald Trump spoke up and said, no, this is a Democratic bill, and the Republicans all ran the other direction. It has to be said, the Republicans clearly do not want to solve this problem. I mean, whatever one thinks of the approach that the president and the Democratic Party have taken, they have tried seriously to find approaches to tackle this very difficult problem. Republicans do not want to tackle the problem. The problem is good for them politically, and anything that they can do to increase it, exacerbate it, make it clear to the American people how out of control the situation is and that it's President Biden's fault, they're going to do that. And they have done that in spades this year. It's incredibly cynical politics, but it's the game they're playing.
Edward Alden there with Doris Meissner. My thanks to them and to Gustavo Solis. And my conclusion, given what we've heard, the one thing you can be reasonably sure of is that this won't be solved by November. And just before we go, if you'd like to hear more about the news that's defining the United States, why not subscribe to the Americast podcast on BBC Sounds? In their latest episode, Sarah Smith, Justin Webb and Mariana Spring have been talking about the divisive student protests over the Israel-Gaza conflict that have swept across American universities. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden. And the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Helen Lewis, and I have a question. What links family WhatsApp dramas?
I flounced off after someone made a particularly ignorant comment.
Russian state propaganda.
It's a very good platform for spreading all this pro-Putin position.
And a woman who married an AI.
100%, I would never go back to humans ever, ever again.
No idea? Well, they're all examples of how instant messaging has changed the world. Find out more by joining me for my new BBC Radio 4 series, Helen Lewis Has Left the Chat. Subscribe to Helen Lewis Has Left the Chat on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.